Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Later in the program, one of the nation's leading land power thinkers, retired U.S. Army Colonel Dr. Gian Gentile of the RAND Corporation's Arroyo Center. But first, if it all goes as planned, by the time you hear this, the President of the United States will have signed into law the $95 billion aid package for Ukraine, Israel, Gaza, and to bolster Indo-Pacific warfighting capabilities. Russia has again threatened the United States and accelerated attacks on Ukraine before more U.S. and allied aid arrives. Joining us today, as he does so regularly, to look at the mechanics and the details of Russia's war on Ukraine is Sam Bendett of the Center for Naval Analyses, where he is one of the think tank's crack Russia team. He's also one of the world's leading experts, not just on the Russian military, but on manned systems. He's also a fellow at the Center for New American Security, as well as the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Sam, welcome back. Always a pleasure having you on.
Thanks. Great to be back.
And before we get started, a word from the sponsor of our monthly updates on land warfare. American Rheinmetall is supporting the U.S. Armed Forces on critical programs that enhance lethality, mobility, and situational awareness, including innovative precision fires, smart mission systems, and tracked and wheeled combat vehicles. Sam, thanks very much again for joining us. U.S. is going to be sending more weapons to Ukraine, and they are desperately needed, as we discussed last week with our mutual friend Eugene Rumer of Carnegie. Some analysts, however, are worrying that it is not enough aid, that it's enough to keep Ukraine from losing, but not necessarily enough to help it win. It appears good news that long-range U.S. ATACMS missiles will be in this bunch as well. What jumps out at you about the air package as we know it now? And is it enough to help Ukraine actually prevail in this war, given they're using up almost everything as fast, if not faster, than we're producing them, whether it's air defense missiles, artillery, or anything else?
It's important to acknowledge that the aid package was finally passed, and now the aid is actually going to head to Ukraine where it's needed the most. I think what's important to acknowledge is that the aid package actually has systems and vehicles that Ukrainians have been asking for, like armored vehicles, like M113s and others. Obviously, artillery and air defense systems and electronic warfare systems and counter UAS systems are in the package, something that has been on the top of the Ukrainian list, something we've discussed for many weeks prior to the passage of this aid. And this is something that's going to have an impact. Whether or not this is a long-term solution, really, I think, depends on a number of factors. One of those factors is how Ukrainians will use these. Ukrainians have gotten very efficient in using whatever weapons and systems they have at their disposal, whether it's former Soviet, whether it's developed in Ukraine after the 1990s, whether it's Western type of a system, or whether it's a hybrid system that combines elements of former Soviet and Western technologies. So Ukrainians are going to apportion this aid at the sections of the front where they're needed the most. Obviously, no aid package is big enough to cover the entirety of the front, but Ukrainians know exactly where the pressure should be applied and where more defenses are necessary.
Indeed. Let's briefly discuss the Russian attacks that are being stepped up, as well as rhetoric against America, although that's not new. And indeed, military and information operations worldwide, right? I mean, there's a breaking story as we discuss this, but the European Parliament is considering measures to expose and counter Russian agents that actually may be in the midst of the body. What are the Russians doing, and should we expect the Russians to really be stepping up operations before aid comes, and what nature is that going to take? You know, we saw the television tower in Kharkiv get hit. Residents of Kharkiv are saying we're not going anywhere and we're not going to get intimidated by the Russians, which is a great fighting spirit. What should we expect to see from the Russians?
I think it's interesting to remember that the Russian military doctrine actually includes attacks on the adversarial economic and industrial infrastructure as part of its official overall approach to war. So it's not surprising that Russians were hitting Ukrainian energy infrastructure beginning in 2022, as soon as they got Shahed drones. So we should expect Russians to continue the same, to step up the pressure, to attack a lot of industrial infrastructure across the country, not just in the largest cities, but probably in other cities, to use drones to clear ways for missile attacks as well, and to maintain pressure on the ground to keep sending soldiers and equipment in places where Russians think they are trying to accomplish a breakthrough, like around Chasiv Yar.
Let me take you to the question of long-range ATACMS. This is a system that Kyiv has asked for a long time. It got the reduced-range version of the cluster bomb equipped, cluster munition equipped version of the weapon. How, you know, if this report is true and President Zelensky has said that President Biden has assured him that that those weapons will be in this package, how do they change the nature of the war or what we should expect next?
Well, they allow for a much stronger punch against the Russian forces. They allow for greater destructive capabilities against Russian military and the concentrations of Russian forces. They allow for longer range attacks against the concentration of Russian forces and materiel. So I think at this point, and this is something we've covered before, anything has an impact. Anything that Ukrainians can get is actually going to go to the front and will contribute to the Ukrainian defenses and even in some cases counteroffensive. Obviously, Ukrainians are warning that Russians may launch a significant offensive against their forces sometime in the summer before the bulk of the aid arrives. And this is something that Ukrainians are trying to prepare for, and they're trying to allocate and prioritize their forces for that impending offensive.
Let me ask you one last question, which is the Ukrainians continue to punch deep into Russia. And indeed, even if the situation is on the front line kind of dire and Kharkiv is being bombarded and more than a million people still don't have power, the Ukrainians managed to shoot down a Tu-22 bomber some 185 miles into Russia with an S-200 system, and two Kinzhals were shot down by Patriot. But at the same time, they're also stepping up their attacks on Russia. Bring us up to speed on the latest Ukrainian efforts to hit the Russians and hit them deep.
Well, this year we're seeing a very significant change in Ukrainian drone tactics, where there's a switch from striking a lot of civilian sites, including Moscow, for example, to striking at the energy infrastructure and the industrial infrastructure across Russia, to trying to strike and hit Russians where it hurts the most. Again, energy. And Ukrainians have demonstrated that their long-range drones are actually capable of penetrating deep inside Russia, that Russian air defenses and electronic warfare defenses are not absolute. There are significant gaps which are exploited. There's now sort of a bit of a turmoil in some of the Russian companies, for example, and some industries, because the Russian government told these industries that the cost of buying and installing counter-UAS, counter-UAV systems is now passed on to these corporations and companies. So basically, Russian companies now have to spend their own resources trying to come up with ways to defend against Ukrainian drones. And there's now some visible dissent on that topic, simply because some are saying that it is the job of the Russian defense and the interior ministry to protect the hinterland from adversarial attacks in the first place. Right. So this is having an impact, although it's not having a desired impact in the sense that Russian economy is not slowing down. It's not affected. Russian revenues are not affected. But Ukrainians have demonstrated that they can step off these attacks and hit the Russians where it hurts the most. What is obviously going to have an impact are continuous large-scale attacks on Russian infrastructure, which is probably what the Ukrainians are gearing up for, because in December of last year, and we have talked about this, Ukrainian government pledged to build 10,000 mid- to long-range UAVs, of which 1,000 are going to be long-range UAVs with a range of up to 1,000 kilometers right, that can hit most of Russia's European territory, where the bulk of the industry and the bulk of the infrastructure is located. So as Russia is expected to step up its attacks against Ukrainian military, Ukrainian civilian infrastructure, Ukrainians can actually respond in kind. Now, whether or not this policy will be pressured by the United States or will be influenced by the United States in one way or another because of concern of how that will impact global energy markets remains to be seen. For now, Ukraine has demonstrated that a nation under extreme pressure from Russia can still have enough technological know-how and successes to actually build long-range drones that can hurt Russia. Again, to what extent remains to be seen.
Sam, always a pleasure having you on. Thanks so very much, and look forward to having you back on again soon. Thanks again.
Thanks so much, Rago.
And joining me now is one of the nation's leading land warfare thinkers, retired United States Army Colonel Dr. John Gentile. He is a senior military historian at the RAND Corporation's Arroyo Center, the United States Army's only federally funded research and development center. He is advising the U.S. Army leadership on strategy, and we're honored to have him on the program today. John, thanks so very much for joining us, and it's been entirely too long before we've had you on this program. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Vago.
Let's start with the Ukraine war. You maintain that folks might be learning the wrong lessons from the conflict, right? This is a conflict where everybody has become sort of an armchair strategist. From your standpoint, what are the lessons from Ukraine broadly we should be learning? And what are the lessons that you think are more specifically applicable, say, to the U.S. Army and land forces in the Indo-Pacific, right? Because folks are making a direct comparison, and it might be a little strained.
Right. I think one of the big lessons that is generally applicable, certainly to Indo-PACOM, is the role of overhead sensors. Now, what those overhead sensors look like, whether they're gobs and gobs of small UASs like we see right now on the front lines of Ukraine, is one thing. Sensors could also mean high-level sensors, space platforms, high-flying UAS, more sophisticated UAS. So I think that is one lesson that's probably generalizable about that, meaning the importance of sensors. But again, we got to be careful that we don't take the current front line of Ukraine, which we know is a line of contact of probably 15 to 20 kilometers on each side, where UAS, small UAS, some medium, some space sensors, of course, but small UAS dominate that front line. We should not think about that as a template that will be applied directly to, say, if China invaded the across the Taiwan Straits to invade Taiwan, for example. I think another generalizable lesson that I think applies to warfare writ large in the future, because of the omnipresence of sensors, again, what depending on the type of combat and the forces involved, that can vary, is going to be the importance of decentralization. And also, I think what we're also, and I'm extrapolating this from the Ukraine war, is the likelihood of potentially gaps in understanding, especially if we're looking at a war somewhere in the Indo-Pacific, where the terrain is much more spread out, obviously a maritime theater. But again, I really want to highlight the point that we should be paying attention to the war in Ukraine. We should also be paying attention to the war in Gaza. I think there's some very, very interesting comparisons. And I think what we're seeing in Gaza, not to get ahead of things, but what we're seeing in Gaza should temper our looking at Ukraine as the template for what modern or what future war looks like.
And talk to us a little bit about that. And I'm going to then go, because you were with a delegation and you went to Poland and a couple of other countries forward to sort of get the temperature on some of these very issues. But talk to us a little bit about Gaza, because, you know, folks are looking at that and saying, look, I mean, one of the criticisms you made about the counterinsurgency strategy was it wasn't particularly well thought through, whether it was in Iraq and Afghanistan. And the criticism now in Israel is, hey, you guys really don't have a strategy. You're doing a bit of whack-a-mole. We know you got to fight these guys, but you're incurring too high civilian casualties. You're doing it because you also disrupted sort of the highly disciplined targeting system you had. You automated a couple of pieces of this. What are the lessons that you know, and as a consequence now, Israel is, you know, instead of garnering support in the wake of October 7, is actually losing support. So what are some of the lessons you see in Gaza? Because there is this tendency of thinking of one size fits it all, and the U.S. Army has to do it all. U.S. Army has to be able to do this in Europe. It's got to be able to do it in the Indo-Pacific, and it's got to be able to do it in a desert, God forbid, again.
For one thing, I do not think that, I mean, I've read suggestions that the Israelis should be adopting a type of counterinsurgency approach that the U.S. applied or tried to apply in Iraq and Afghanistan. Population-centric counterinsurgency was sort of the common term for it, where the idea is that you have a population that's undecided on who to support, rather the insurgent or counterinsurgent force. And then a counterinsurgent force can go into that population, get in the midst of it, provide it things like, you know, build schools, improve institutions, and you can win the population over to your side. That is, in a nutshell, the approach that the U.S. Army took throughout Iraq and Afghanistan the entire time. I don't think that's a feasible military approach to for the Israelis, at least right now, to take in Gaza. For one, the Palestinian population largely is in support of Hamas. And so the idea that there's a bunch of fence sitters there just waiting to be won over is not the case. As far as military lessons taken from Gaza, again, going back to Ukraine, the interesting thing, at least from a military standpoint, and acknowledging the terrible things that happen in war, but as professional soldiers, airmen, sailors, it's important for us to study ongoing wars. The interesting thing, again, thinking about in comparison Gaza to Ukraine, is Gaza is turning out very different. We don't see the omnipresence of small UAS in Gaza like we see in Ukraine. Again, hence the challenges of trying to use Ukraine, Blago, as a template for all future war. I think the other thing, that a clearly generalizable lesson from Gaza, which I experienced in West Baghdad in 2006, you've seen a lot of that on the ground yourself, is that urban combat is really, really super difficult. Regardless of the mission that one has, if there's some kind of conflict going on, urban combat presents all kinds of challenges that are very, very different from what we see in Ukraine right now, what we might see in an Indo-PACOM fight. There's lots of angles in urban combat. I mean, they're staring in your faces, windows, sides of buildings. And then especially what we're seeing in Gaza, which we also need to be paying attention to, is the role of tunnels that Hamas is using. And the Israelis are trying to figure out how to get into those tunnels and their various forms to destroy Hamas. So I think those are the probably, at least for me, comparative aspect between Ukraine and Gaza, the difficulty, challenges of urban combat, and the uniqueness, I think, what we're seeing right now in Gaza, especially with the extensive tunnel network that Hamas is using.
I also, right, I mean, you also have a leadership, a political movement who does not value the lives of their own citizens, right? In fact, are more than happy to put them in between the combatants. Yes. In order to be able to shape the narrative and shape the battle. And in that case, they are succeeding because it's innocent people who are getting in the midst of this.
Really, if I could, Vago, I mean, the type of combat I experienced in West Baghdad in 2006 was not as intense as it is for Israeli soldiers, but it was the height of the Shia-Sunni war. And we experienced that. Civilians there, IED goes off, there's nobody to shoot at, which is a really hard thing for a soldier to have to deal with. So it is a very, very, very tough combat environment.
Let me take you, you're an illustrious Jian, tanker and cavalryman. And, you know, over the past many decades, you know, I mean, we'd both probably go rich the number of times somebody has written a thumbsucker on the death of the tank, erecting a tombstone on a vehicle that, if used the right way, can be very effective and can still be very, very effective. There are those who are making the case, hey, look, by the end of the year, there'll be a first-person video drone over every soldier and vehicle on the battlefield. What that does that mean for the tank? What does that mean for armored vehicles and the prosecution of a campaign? Because unfortunately, we're in the situation we're in because neither side has got air superior. You know, I mean, there are a lot of unique elements to how everything is playing out here. The Chinese are supplying both sides, right? What is the epitaph of tanks, armored vehicles, and what formations look like in the future? Or again, is Ukraine sort of a different case?
Yes. I mean, well, first, I don't know if I call. Thank you for calling me illustrious. I think barely surviving armored cavalry is probably a better sobriquet to apply. But I love it. Like unique. One thing military history shows is, and history shows in general, is the absolute contingency in historical affairs and events. And in that sense, all wars are unique, and Ukraine is unique, just like Gaza is. I'm not ready to apply an epitaph for the tank. I don't think the tank is dead. I mean, you've recounted, you know, the standard line, you know, after the 73 war, the tank was dead. A couple of tanks, you know, are destroyed in a Gulf War, the tank is dead. If the tank is dead, then why do the Ukrainians want tanks so badly? I also think, Bago, that this notion that the tank is dead is embedded within the current situation or context of the Ukraine war right now, which is stalemated, and it is a very much a defensive war. And so this argument of whether or not the tank is alive or is dead is embedded, I think, within a larger argument that a number of people have made in different articles and national security blogs, whatever, that the defense has become the dominant form of war, which personally, I don't agree with that. I think the offensive is still the dominant form of war. The problem is that offensive operations are very, very hard in war. And I think the current situation in Ukraine has perhaps led people to think that there's no real role the tank anymore. We know, I think now looking in hindsight, the mistakes that we made in terms of hoping that the Ukrainians could pull off a Kharkiv version 2. Last summer, spring, summer of 2023 with their counteroffensive, I think we were too ambitious in thinking that we could train and equip a Ukrainian counteroffensive force. Even I think, didn't really understand at the time how deeply the Russians were digging in. And I think that was a mistake. And I think our biggest mistake was not understanding that if the U.S. Army Joint Force was going to carry out that kind of ground land operation in a counteroffensive, that you need some kind of air power capability above. Doesn't mean that you apply the U.S. Air Force or a NATO Air Force, but it has to be some kind of air power capability. Maybe it's pulsed. But the Ukrainians certainly lack that capability. And then the other thing, Vago, and this goes back to your original question of the current situation in Ukraine, stalemated. That's the wave of the future. The tank is dead. The defensive is a stronger form of war. Maybe not. If the Ukrainians, and I still think it's in the realm of the possible, if the U.S. and NATO can continue to provide support, and in my own view, if the U.S. continues to lead, and if we have strategic patience and give it time, it's still in the realm of the possible for the Ukrainians to build a counteroffensive force. And if they're able to do that, and if we're able to provide them, or if they're able to get some kind of pulsed air power capability, and they can penetrate operationally in a deep way the current Russian line of contact in Ukraine, then bets are all off. And then the role of small UAS, as it looks right now, looks very, very different in that kind of combat environment.
Fascinating observation, Gian. Let me take you to how the Army is changing. So you've seen cultural changes, and indeed you're the second guest, or the first of two guests this week. We're going to be talking about those cultural changes. General John Jumper, the 17th Chief of Staff of the U.S. Air Force, is joining us tomorrow for the Air Power podcast to discuss that, given his career started in Vietnam, two tours in Vietnam, and then ended in 2005. Well, I want to get your sense on, you know, the Army has announced a whole series of changes. Obviously, the Air Force has announced a whole series of changes as well. You could argue that Jim McConville and the leadership have been pressing kind of a focus on the Indo-Pacific. General Odierno was building sort of the foundations for some of this. From your standpoint, rather than critique what they're doing and how they're doing it, right, because I don't want to cross-thread you, but what are the keys to getting that cultural transition right? Because the U.S. Army can both be, like any military organization, the most pigheaded in the world, or be able to change at a speed that gives you just goosebumps when you watch it, right? Like everybody gets it. And when that light goes off, it's like a freight train changing direction. That's a bad analogy. But anyway, you get the point. What are the keys to making this transition a success in your mind? Because as you've always argued, it's really about the thousand details, right? It's the headline goal, but each one of those has got a to-do list of a thousand details under it.
I was commissioned in 1986. I spent my first 3 years in a tank battalion in Germany, and then commanded a tank company in Korea for 2 years. That was the Army I came up with, a very much high-end combat warfighting Army. And then in the 90s, and then of course 2001, and we get into Iraq and Afghanistan. And my criticism of the Army during the Iraq War, and then even in Afghanistan, was not that we should be telling political leaders we have no business doing counterinsurgency. I was never saying that. What I was arguing was that we need to be clear and critical with ourselves about what we think counterinsurgency as operations as we were applying them in Iraq and Afghanistan can achieve. And I also made a related argument that says, yes, this is the mission we have now. So the Army has to be carrying out in Iraq and Afghanistan a counterinsurgency like operation, but let's not take our eye off the ball. And the ball being that the main purpose, in my view, it was at the time, still is, for the United States Army, is to be able to conduct high-end conventional combat operations. If it can do that, it can step in a different direction to do counterinsurgency correctly. And I got to tell you, Vago, I think by and large, maybe I was just hyper fearful that we were going too far in the counterinsurgency direction, but the Army didn't make the kind of changes that a lot of the COIN advocates were recommending, like major structures. Since I started at RAND in 2014, I think from my view, the Army does understand that counterinsurgency is over, that we learned a lot of things from counterinsurgency. Some are applicable, some are not for the future. And the Army really is trying to embrace and understand what high-end combat conventional operations looks like in the future. It may have to do a lot of other things, but first and foremost, it has to be able to do that. There's been a lot of criticism of the Army's multi-domain operations, and some of those criticisms are fair, but I liked it from the start. Because for one, the Army understood that it needed to understand to create a new doctrine that allowed it to fight high-end combat. And the other thing that I like a lot about multi-domain operations is the Army sees itself as a part of the joint force, not always as the supported force, but sometimes, especially in the Indo-PACOM theater, the Army likely in many cases in a fight in Indo-PACOM will be the supporting force. And I think the Army actually has embraced that and understands its role in the Indo-Pacific theater is very different from the role that it will play in the European theater. I think the one, and this is a tough one, but the one challenge that the Army still faces, and it's not just the Army, Vago, I think it's the entire joint force, and it's really hard to put your arms around this, is that if we do have to face be involved in high-end combat, the U.S. Army, and again, this is the joint force too, the Navy, Air Force, Marines, even the most highly professionalized, well-trained fighting force with exquisite munitions will still suffer attrition in high-end combat. And if there's one thing that Ukraine shows us and Gaza shows us, is that attrition cannot be outmaneuvered by fancy maneuver on the ground, air, or sea, and we are going to take losses. And I think that is maybe the one challenge that not the Army, but the joint force really needs to confront. You're not going to get away from attrition. It's not that you are saying that you are an attrition-based Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines. You're not. But you have to accept that in high-end combat, attrition is going to happen. And you are going to lose forces in larger numbers than we did in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Indeed. And that's where I think we all have to get a lot more honest about it, right? We're going to lose a lot more airplanes, whether on the ground or in the air. We're going to lose a lot more ships, right? I mean, Mark Busby, the former head of the Maritime Administration, used to say, like, hey, we've got 80 some odd ships in the transport fleet, 50 some odd of them will be sunk in the first week of an Indo-Pacific war. And we just have to be cognizant of that. And this is, you're not going to be building replacements that quickly, right? And your adversary knows that. So, you go into the game with a little, you're going to come out, you're going to be vulnerable. We've got about 2 minutes left. I want to ask you two questions. First, does the Army have the right? The Army has been criticized for not having the right vision for what its Indo-Pacific role is. Do you think they have the right vision? And then I have one more question. I want to ask about technology.
Yeah, I think, yes, I think right now the Army has the right vision. I'll be a mercenary here and tout a RAND report I had published and colleagues had published about a year ago. It's an infographic where we lay out what we see as the Army's major roles in the Indo-Pacific theater. The long-range fires clearly are important. Some ground-based units, what the Army does in terms of theater-wide sustainment and assistance and command and control is really, really important. And I think the Army does understand the difference between its role in the Indo-Pacific theater and what its role would be in the European theater. And then just one quick add-on to my previous comment. I think all the services, and especially the Army, and this is tied to this problem of attrition, is what we're really seeing from Ukraine is the importance of the defense industrial base for all of the services, especially in the United States. And that is something that we really have to confront as well.
Let me take you to technology. Our soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, Guardians, Coast Guardsmen, right? They all have access to some of the finest technology in the world, but every once in a while it fails. And what you have to realize in land warfare is that just like the domains are against you, sometimes the sea is violent, the air can be dangerous. It's a long fall. The ground can be problematic. And I know the Army has tried to, reduce the number of crews and vehicles. I remember when the French Leclerc tank came out, it had a three-person crew, and there were folks who were critical in the U.S. Army saying, hey, you need four people because you got to break track. And, tanks, the greatest thing about armored vehicles is they're armored, but doing anything on an armored vehicle is hard and heavy and dirty work and dangerous when you're getting shot at, right? Now there's a drive. Hey, let's go to a three-man M1. Hey, when we do the next generation of vehicle, let's go to a two-man vehicle for the Bradley replacement.
Yeah.
What does history teach us? You still have to break track. That's a hard, hard thing to do on the best of circumstances, unless you're buried in mud. You're waiting for the recovery vehicle to come. It gets stuck in the mud, right? How do we need to think about technology, the role of technology? And the fact is, hands matter, man. I mean, I don't want to sound like a Luddite, right? But what's the balance point here?
Yeah, and qualified on an M60A3, an M1 IP, an M1A1, an M3A3, and a M2, M3A2, the last two Bradleys and the first three tanks. I mean, I understand the importance about tank crew duties. And also, I was a SAMS planner in the 4th Infantry Division when it was the digital test division. So I also understand the importance of technology, and my 10 years at RAND now doing a lot of work for the Army, working with senior Army leaders. It's a tough one. So I'm going to split the difference, Vago, with you. And this may sound like heresy to my brother and sister armor people out there. But the tension is this, right? I mean, the M1, the current M1 A2 SEP V3, now moving to SEP V4, I'm biased, is the greatest tank that's ever rolled on the face of the earth. But it is heavy. That thing, you start adding stuff onto it, protection systems, it's 80 plus tons. You've got to figure out how to make that. You still need mobile protected firepower. You still need a tank. Maybe the three-person, three-man crew is the way to go. technology certainly comes into play. And I mean, if we're looking at the XM30, the next version of the US tank, it will be AI capable. There's a role for AI, but I also think in here, I'll team up with you on being a Luddite. Even technology is going to fail. So with that, we need to train our soldiers. For me, as an Army person, we need to train our soldiers, our officers, our leaders, that sometimes technology is going to fail. I do believe on an MDO battlefield, it's not all going to be seamless. There are going to be black holes sometimes of breakdowns in comms. And that is where the Army's idea of mission command, intent, right, commander's intent, that's where it comes into play. When those systems break down, you don't have a radio comms with your higher commander, and you need to be able to carry on at least for a while until those systems come back up.
John, thanks so very much. So much more I want to discuss, but unfortunately we're short on time today. Thanks so much for joining us, and look forward to having you back on again soon.
Thank you, Vagu. Great to be here.
And thanks to all of you for joining us. We appreciate you listening. We'll be back again tomorrow with the Air Power Podcast. And joining us will be the 17th Chief of Staff of the United States Air Force, retired General John Jumper, veteran from of the two-time service in Vietnam, and somebody who had an extraordinary career that spanned numerous cultural revolutions as the United States Army, the United States Air Force tries to reoptimize itself for great power competition. Thanks very much for joining us. Have a great day, and we'll see you again tomorrow.